This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Health and Living segment. It's our public health series with my co-host Azrul Muhammad Khalib, the CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. And today's topic is it, and we're going to be discussing whether or not it's the end game for dengue. In 2021, Malaysia recorded the lowest number of dengue cases since the last decade. I think we sort of measured it over 1 year for the first 8 months in the year 2020 and the year 2021. And that we saw a reduction of 74.1% in the number of cases. It's been a hard-won victory with dengue, proving stubbornly persistent within the community over the past decades. But Health Director General Tan Sri Dr. Noor Hisham Abdullah has also cautioned that cases may spike again in the next five-year cycle. What do we need to learn from our recent achievements in bringing the dengue cases down, and what are the control measures that we need to ramp up to ensure that we don't repeat the same mistakes? So joining us also, Professor Dr. Lucy Lam, Senior Consultant Pediatrician at University of Malaya Medical Center. Probably wondering why a pediatrician is on the show today. Well, she has a huge interest in dengue and has worked pretty much a lot actually in the space of dengue fever. Welcome to the show, Professor Lucy. How are you today?
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mira, for inviting me to this show.
You're most welcome. Azrul, how are you today?
I'm doing good, Mira. I'm just looking outside and it looks like it's going to be stormy soon. So hopefully.
It has been, isn't it? Every evening, faithfully. Yeah. Some of us, some rain has to come down. But let's start with Professor Lucy. I mean, as a pediatrician, what got you interested in dengue?
That started when I first started working in this hospital, in the University of Malaya Medical Center, about 30 years ago. I was a young pediatrician and I worked in the acute care medicine part. And so during those years in the early 1990s, weekly, we would see a dengue shock patient. So even though dengue has been with us for a few 30 to 40 years, but seeing a shock patient and learning to manage them takes a lot of effort and it takes us a lot of time to learn, but we had to do it fast. And fortunately, we had some very senior pediatric consultants then, Professor Rebecca George, one of them, and Professor S.K. Lam, who was a virologist. So they were the experienced people who guided us through those early years.
Carry on, please.
Yeah, so over the years, we kind of learned from our experience and quite often some mistakes as well, that we were doing it really quite reactively, reactively meaning we were reacting to too many things when we could have just kind of like be a bit more careful, be a bit more controlled. So then we started to be a little bit, a step back and look at the whole picture. And that was after we had about 100 shock patients. And we wrote a paper and it was during the analysis that I realized that, oh my God, we were overdoing quite a bit of the fluid management beyond that phase. And so some of the children went into trouble and then we had to rescue them. So, during when you're in the thick of it, you really don't see it. It's only when things are settled down and then when we relook at our data, and I think that was about 8 years later when we had a chance to relook at our data, then we said, oh my God, our patients were already peeing so much and then we didn't realize, we didn't turn off the fluid and all that. So then we started to be a bit more careful with the fluid. And then when we went to international meetings and shared with other pediatricians from other countries, particularly those from Thailand, and the senior consultants in Thailand, they have been there, right from the beginning, from the 50s, 60s. So they were very, very kind to share the experience with us and you know, kind of like, okay, guided us through this. Yes, you only need to be very fast for a very short period of time. And after that, you have to pull back your interventions. Otherwise, you will go over to the other side. So we learn to kind of like be a bit more timely, look out, be a bit more, rather than reactive, is to be like identify the potential risk, what is lying ahead. So we are kind of like two steps ahead of the patient. So that, and that was how, you know, over the years we teach our students now, you know, you with dengue, you can't afford to be reactive. Okay, you can be reactive for a short period of time. After that, you've got to get your bearings. And then after that, you've got to be two steps ahead of the patient so that then you can pull them back. So that was how we learned over the years.
Okay.
But unfortunately, by the time the pediatricians became good with our management, what the disease, you know, kind of passed us by. Went to the adults. And
as they always
do. I remember
that
one time. I always remember the adult patients, doctors were telling us, what's wrong with your pediatricians? Why your patients are so difficult and all that? I say, wait till your time comes.
I mean, and I suppose dengue was recorded in our country, you know, in the turn of the last century, but only it became a public health problem in the 1970s, right? And children below the age of...
Penang. We started off, the first reported cases were in Penang in the 1960s.
Right. And children below the age of 15 were worst hit, right? So hence the need for the pediatricians to sort of get involved. And you were fighting, you know, in the front line before even the adults. Azrul, you have, you want to just add on to that?
Well, you know, I want to go back to a point that you made just now in your introduction, Mira, and that is, you know, with the lowest number of dengue cases in over the last decade, it's been a hard-won victory. And I don't want to put cold water or put a damp towel over that, but it could be a premature conclusion to make because, you know, dengue has been around for quite a while. We've been talking about endemic diseases for quite a while, right? Recently because of COVID.
Yes.
And malaria is one of those endemic diseases that's been around in the Malaysian seen for quite a while. We've been having to struggle with that. And we've not had a lot of successes, unfortunately. And that's where learning from our past mistakes is very important, especially in how we deal with children. And, you know, also in terms of hemorrhagic dengue as well, which I'm hoping that Dr. Lucy will talk a little bit about. But, you know, I'm interested to hear from Dr. Lucy what you think, how has, you know, the struggle concerning dengue evolved? What have we learned? What kind of lessons do you think that has jumped out to you over the past 4 decades?
Can I just clarify? Dengue is considered endemic in Malaysia now. Am I correct? It is, right?
It is, yes.
So you want to talk about how it has evolved over the 4 decades, Dr. Professor Lucy?
Yeah, actually, the term that we people use is not just endemic. It is hyper-endemic. Meaning that when we talk about endemicity in dengue, because there are 4 serotypes, and in the past it would be like each outbreak there is 1 serotype that is predominant, and then you know, people will then everybody will get the infection, and then we develop herd immunity, and then nobody gets that infection anymore because it is lifelong protection from the natural infection. And then the next serotype will come in, and then those people who have never had the second, the new serotype will then fall ill. So that would be an endemic situation. But now we are facing a situation which we call hyper-endemic, meaning that all the 4 serotypes are actually circulating in the same country and probably within the same state, but maybe different parts of the city, you know, like Gombak may have something that is different from Klang, but then we know that Klang and Gombak, you know, people are just traveling every day. So now we are seeing all the 4 serotypes circulating. All right. And this is a situation where it is ripe for the severe manifestation of dengue. So that brings us to what you mentioned, Prof. Azrul, about the hemorrhagic manifestation of dengue. So this usually occurs with the second dengue infection. The first dengue infection may be completely silent, completely no symptoms, and which is vast majority, about 75% of cases are completely quiet. They don't even know, but they are viremic and they are capable. It's like COVID, you know, you're a silent carrier and transmitting the virus. But it's the second infection that is usually the severe one. But most secondary infections are also quite mild. It's just that the severe ones are the second ones, lah. And the second ones are the ones where the first infection has produced the antibodies, and those antibodies to the first infection are now interacting with the second virus that is being introduced to the body, and that is facilitating the entry of that virus into the host cell for multiplication. All right. So then there is an easier entry, and then there is a higher viremic load, and therefore a higher inflammatory response, and therefore a more severe disease now, in that sense. So when you have four serotypes all circulating in one point, so there is this higher incident, higher chances of getting a second infection within a very close. The first one may be very completely silent. You think that is your first infection, but in actual fact, it is not your first infection. The first infection, you might think that, oh, why is it severe? But in actual fact, when you do a seroprevalence, you might feel that you already have a previous infection.
So if I could ghost on a bit, Dr. Lucy, you know, essentially for Malaysia, we see, I think, dengue 1 to 4, right? 1, 2, 3, 4 serotypes.
Yes, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4 serotypes that exist within the Malaysian scene. And it's not possible to identify one dominant serotype for Malaysia. You're saying that in different parts of the country, in fact, even different parts of the Klang Valley, you can have different serotypes that are applicable for those. And therefore, how does this affect treatment? Obviously, we're looking at two things now, because this is a vector-borne disease, right? We're talking about the mosquito itself and then the disease. So right now, we are focusing very much on the disease. So if you wanted to control the spread of the Anopheles mosquito, the mosquito itself, right? Is there a way to identify which mosquito has serotype 1, 2, 3, or 4? Are they identified in a certain way? I remember those huge mosquito models, you know, that they bring to school, and then they say, this is how that Anopheles mosquito looks like. This is bringing dengue. This is what you should look out for. And people are told to be on a lookout for this. Is there a way for us to identify which mosquito has more severe dengue?
Unfortunately, I'm not an entomologist. Usually, it would be the entomologist who should answer. But from my very limited knowledge of entomology, it is not so much the. I don't think the mosquito, the Aedes, either the Aedes aegypti or the Aedes albopictus, has a preferential. Preference for the virus. I don't think so. It is just everything is just. Chance, you call it chance or whatever lah. You want to call it nature. In nature, that is like this, yeah. But I don't think it is the fault of the mosquitoes to carry the virus. That is how the virus needs to survive.
Yeah, it's almost like Russian roulette, isn't it? You just don't know which one's actually going to hit you. We'll come back and find out more about the factors that determine dengue outbreaks in Malaysia, because, I was reading that, you know, climate variability is of huge concern, and it's one of the factors. I mean, we always used to tell people, you know, make sure you don't have stagnant water anywhere in the house and all of that. And it was always a responsibility on our part as well. But if climate variability is is also of something that sort of determines dengue outbreaks. And given climate change and everything, what does that mean for dengue fever going forward? So we'll come back and find out. You can WhatsApp your questions on dengue. Is it the end game in sight for dengue? WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or just tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back in our Health and Living series. It's our public health show. Is it the end game for dengue fever? Well, co-hosting with me, Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, and Professor Dr. Lucy Lam, Senior Consultant Paediatrician from University of Malaya Medical Centre. It's fascinating how, you know, we had dengue outbreaks in the 1970s. It was a big problem and now it is considered hyper-endemic. How interesting is that? We saw the peak in the 1980s, I think. Professor Lucy, no? When was the peak, would you say?
I'd say that the peak would be within the last 10, 20 years, in the new millennium. We were seeing a lot more cases. And I think the peak was 2014, 2015. When we had more than 300 deaths, you know, and that was something that I was on the panel looking at every one of them. So it was really quite frightening during that time. But the doctors were really inundated. The wards, I remember, were so full that the people, I mean, it was like the COVID, maybe not as bad as the COVID. People were just camping out on camp beds. Yeah, in some of the hospitals.
What do you think contributed to that peak? And then after that, I mean, we're seeing a 70% drop. What do you think led to that sort of pattern?
I think it is not to be unexpected because almost like we are getting more and more congested in our city. There is a lot of movement. People were going around doing their usual stuff. But the thing is that these usual things that we do enable the spread of the breeding of the mosquitoes. And because we are moving around, the mosquitoes then have a chance to bite transmit the diseases through us as well, through human beings. So I think that in those days, the activity was a lot. And the year 2021 is so atypical. You know, people were locked down. If they had a dengue infection, they would be at home. They would not be mixing with friends. And so the mosquitoes will not have a chance to bite. And we don't have a chance to spread other diseases. It's not just dengue that was down. It was almost every infectious disease. Pneumococcal, you talk about pneumococcal, you talk about other viral infections. They were all down. So then it just shows that, you know, these interactions, social and physical interactions between humans are mainly the cause of the spread of any infectious diseases.
You know, it's one of the things that we were scratching our heads over, you know, when we got this announcement, because honestly, yes. Dr. Lucy and Mira, you know, we were expecting to be record highs because of the lack of movement, because of also the weather and the fact that people were more homebound, right? And therefore, there would be more opportunity for mosquitoes to infect people who are staying at home, right? But interestingly enough, this massive drop from back in 2019, it was like 130,000 cases and almost 200 deaths. And then 2020, it was 90,000. And then last year, it was around 26,000. Massive drop, you know. So honestly, some of the speculation that we've been having, because epidemiology-wise, you know, when we look at it, it cannot be attributed to anything man-made intervention. So climate change may have worked in our favor, perhaps, for once. I don't know. But it seems to be such a drastic, because I don't see any change in the behavior of households taking care of, you know, the water betakung, or, you know, spraying and so forth, you know, and I don't see a lot of change in that, right? So I call me a skeptic, but maybe this time climate change worked.
I think we are not the only country that that reported a drop. Every country except Singapore had a bad run in the year 2020 when they had both COVID and dengue. In fact, they were the only country that had both COVID and dengue, both at the same time. The rest of the countries, Vietnam, Thailand, you know, Indonesia, Philippines, they were all reporting low cases.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
I don't think it is, I think it's an anomaly. I don't think it is, it could be underreporting, or patients do not want to come to the hospital. So if they don't come to the hospital, you know, we don't have a self-test like COVID where you can do your own test to find out whether you have dengue. So they could be asymptomatic, or they have some febrile fever. They'll just say, okay, I'll take some paracetamol and then go to sleep. And then they got better. So it was never detected.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that this is a very, very atypical year 2021 in terms of social movements, people moving around. I think it's just a temporary phenomenon.
It's good news for once on dengue, right? So remarkable.
But I'm wondering if it's just temporary, right? I mean, with movement now and but I've always wondered.
Yeah,
I've always wondered about Singapore, Professor Lucy. They are sticklers when it comes to cleanliness and hygiene and everything. Mm-hmm. And I always used to wonder why their dengue cases were also very high. Do we know why?
I think there are many factors, okay? It's not like what we see is really the tip of the iceberg, and what goes on in the iceberg at the bottom part is so many factors. For example, one is herd immunity, all right? If there is no dengue transmission in the or very low transmission, particularly, I think in, Singapore poses a very interesting case study, because for years in the 1980s, I remember when we were medical students, we would like be studying about dengue and all that, and then my lecturer would say, oh, in Singapore, they've done so well, you know, they've almost eradicated dengue, and we're like, like that, you know, wow, their incidents are coming down and all that, because they are such sticklers that you said, you know, to vector control, they control the household index and all that. So the incidence of dengue came around, came very low. But how low? You see, the problem is when there is no transmission, your immunity to dengue also reduces, okay? So when you have a little bit of just one mosquito, one virus, it is enough already to multiply. And then these all loads of people with very low herd immunity, they are susceptible. So they in the late 1980s, they had sudden big outbreaks, even though their household index has already come down in terms of the 80s. They're already down so low already. They're almost like eradicating, but of course you cannot eradicate. Just next door to you is Johor, and then on the other side is all the Indonesians. You're surrounded by a sea of dengue.
So but can they fly that far? I mean, across the ocean.
Well, they don't have to fly. They just like a hitch a ride. They just hitch a ride at home. Okay, and the mosquitoes are very smart. Okay, they just hitch a ride, and then you know. So when you're surrounded, how long can you keep maintain? It's not sustainable. So eventually, they had a big outbreak as well in the 1990s. So it's the same. I think even if we go low, how low can you go, and how long can you stay? Eventually, you will get an outbreak because you cannot eradicate dengue from this planet. And we are the prime harbinger of the breeding sites. We love breeding them.
Yeah, well, so that's community responsibility,
yes.
Right? But let's talk about herd immunity. How would we know if we have reached herd immunity in Malaysia?
Well, we have to run serological surveys. There is no way we can know it unless we... I think this is seroprevalence, what we call the seroprevalence study, to just like a group of people. Well, we hope that are representative of the population, and we can check the antibody levels and see whether they are immune to dengue. And so there are four serotypes, so you don't know. You might be immune to one type, and what about the other three types? So it's not easy to, it's a very challenging disease to kind of study in the population. unless you have a very a study to go in like in some countries in Latin America, in Nicaragua, in Thailand, they have cohort studies where they follow up the same group of children over several years and then see what happens and test their blood. And then only we will know whether they have been infected with dengue. But for the general, you just have to do a blood test.
But it does sound that preventing dengue is impossible then. You just said that it's impossible to eradicate the disease.
Eradicate is not possible, okay? But to control it, I think possible, but it has to be not one particular type of method, what WHO calls an integrated kind of method. It means you will need to have controlling your, I think the environment is the most important. Trying to control the vector is impossible, but that is trying to control our environment. And that is where Singapore is so successful. They control the environment, right? So they control the environment. And for years, they had very, very low incidence of dengue. But of course, the downside is that your herd immunity goes down. And then when you have the infection, when you have the virus in the community, wow, you have an explosion. All these people who have been protected, but now vulnerable.
It's a little bit like COVID in Singapore, isn't it? They didn't have natural immunity in the early parts of the pandemic. I mean, they had an outbreak with the foreign workers and they isolated them completely, whereas the rest of the population didn't build any sort of natural immunity. Mm. It sounds pretty much... So can I be too clean or so long? I mean, I'm like so confused. You have to be a little, you know...
You have to play a bit, dodge the bullets a bit.
I mean, the absence of disease in the community also pun tak boleh.
Tak boleh, yeah, I know, right?
Must have.
Have also problem, don't have also problem.
Yes, true.
So what I'm hearing is factors that could determine outbreaks, herd immunity, climate change, movement, community responsibility, the environment and all of that. So it's as you said, an integrated approach to managing dengue. So that means there is a possibility we could, you know, go back to, and that is what DG Hisham's concern is, isn't it? We shouldn't be resting on our laurels. The spike, we could see a spike again in 5 years. It is a cycle. And what is this cycle about? Why 5 years, Professor Lucy?
It's a herd immunity. It's like your herd immunity. And whoever comes new in the community have never been. At one time, it's our foreign workers from countries like Nepal, where there's not a lot of dengue. So they are the like the sitting ducks for the not the Aedes aegypti, but for the dengue, you see, because they're completely naive. Whereas the workers that come from Indonesia, they have probably already been infected, so they are already immune. So we have newcomers coming into the community, children being born, or people coming from the rural areas where dengue was never a problem, and they're coming into the city. So these are new people moving into the community where the Aedes is very, you know, rife. So these are the things that will change your community herd immunity, the herd immunity.
Okay, we'll come back. Azrul, you had a question on hemorrhagic dengue fever. We'll come back and continue this discussion on whether or not it's the end game. And in my mind, it's not, Professor Lucy. We're far from the end game. You never know when it's going to rear its head again. So if you have a question on dengue, do give WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. It's our Health and Living segment in our public health series. We're discussing the end game, whether or not it's in sight for dengue in Malaysia. I'm co-hosting with me Azrul Muhammad Khalib, the CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, and joining us Professor Dr. Lucy Lam, Senior Consultant Paediatrician at University of Malaya Medical Centre. That's terribly it's been insightful trying to understand the evolution of dengue in Malaysia. It's interesting that it is now hyper-endemic. We are 75% of the population is probably asymptomatic. Am I correct, Professor Lucy? That's interesting to know because I never realized that we could be asymptomatic for dengue. I thought always you would have fever because that's when all of us get ourselves tested. And we've seen a 70% drop from 2020 and 2021 in dengue fever cases and deaths. And that's, as you mentioned, movement restrictions probably played a huge part in that. But we do know that there are many factors that determine dengue outbreaks, herd immunity being one. I never thought of herd immunity at all, actually, when it came to dengue fever. Climate change plays a huge part. As you mentioned, movement restrictions have helped. Community, our responsibility to, you know, make sure we don't have stagnant water in our homes and around us, and the environment plays a huge part. And we also know that it can move in 5-year cycles. We may have low numbers now; those numbers could change in time to come if any of this these factors move or change drastically, right? Or in tandem with each other. So you need an integrated approach to managing dengue in the country. Azrul, you had a question about hemorrhagic fever.
Well, yes, Mira. You know, one of the things that we understand from people who have been treated for dengue, it seems like the treatment regime for dengue hasn't changed much over the past, couple of decades or so. It's the same regime that we've been using. And this is because it's essentially a disease that is very well understood. But as Dr. Lucy mentioned just now, with different serotypes available that you have to respond to, and you have to make sure that you have the right kind of approach to treatment, it becomes hard to understand what is necessary and what is standard for treatment of dengue. And we have heard so much about the danger of hemorrhagic dengue. And the often asked question is, what distinguishes hemorrhagic dengue from so-called normal dengue? How do you end up in such a much more dire state where it can actually cost the life of an individual? So, Dr. Lucy.
Okay, we have for years battled with this term, hemorrhagic dengue. In fact, the term came about in the 1950s and 60s when the hemorrhagic part of it actually is the last stage, the end stage, okay? So to use the term hemorrhagic would mean that the last stage. So that is not very useful when you are kind of recognizing the disease in the final stages, all right? So a much better approach, which WHO has then revised. So the term, this was, the revision took place in the early 2000, when we did it, we knew that it was a problem. People were saying that, hemorrhagic disease, hemorrhagic. Then they will say that, where's the hemorrhage? Where's the hemorrhage? Because if you reach them early, treat them early, they don't have the hemorrhage. But then they will call it, oh, dengue fever, oh, the normal dengue fever. They say, no, this is the severe one, but we managed to save them, but they are actually hemorrhagic. But they'll say, they will label, you know, in the, when we notify to the Ministry of Health that this is dengue fever or dengue hemorrhagic fever. A lot of doctors do not understand the term dengue hemorrhagic fever. They say, there's no hemorrhage. Why are you calling it hemorrhagic fever? So we really, the actual problem, the real pathological problem is not a hemorrhage. The first problem, the first sign that tells you that there is a problem is the plasma leakage. Mm. So it's actually the capillary membrane that has become very permeable. And it suddenly loses its filtration to proteins. So once you have proteins out of the circulation, the water, the electrolytes, everything will go out with it. See? So then the patient, of course, will go into shock. If this is a large amount, that's everything. Suddenly migrates out of the circulation, and then therefore the central circulation will contract, and then the patient goes into shock. And if this is not picked up early, then they will go into hemorrhage. Okay, so there is the timelines between the first plasma leak and the hemorrhage could be about 12 to 24 hours. Of course, you know, 12 to 24 hours. seems like a long time, but in the evolution of the disease during the critical phase, it's very, very fast. From morning to night, the whole disease, the whole patient can look different. All right, so we kind of got used to like teaching the doctors that don't look for the hemorrhage, look for the plasma leak. So that was how we changed the, it was a lot of, there was a lot of resistance to changing it, but I think now people are beginning to think that in terms of severe dengue, okay? So the severe dengue, within that category of severe dengue, the first thing that will tell you that this is severe is that plasma leakage. Okay, that plasma leakage part is when the plasma starts. We tell the patients a kebocoran capillary lah. So the darah kuning, the plasma will leak out first. So there's no blood loss yet. So then that is a time when you start to see the hematocrit going up. See? Now, if you miss that phase, then the shock comes on later, and then the blood pressure drops, and then you will get the bleeding at that point. The bleeding comes very much later. Well, much later means about 6 to 12 hours later. Nah? So we don't want to wait for that. We want to catch the patients when they are start to leaking. And then if we resuscitate them and manage to keep them, prevent them from going into severe shock and get them out of shock, then they don't go into the bleeding.
Right.
Even though their platelet counts are zero, we have seen patients, the platelet count one, platelet count zero, but they don't bleed. You know, because we keep their circulation going with the fluid that we give them, and then later on they will recover themselves. Their bone marrow recovers, and then they bring up their own platelets. So our role as doctors is not to cure the disease, it's to keep the patient alive so that his own body cures exactly. himself.
Yep.
It's a self-limiting condition.
What do you do?
So we are only doing like very hard, very careful monitoring for about 24, 48 hours. And after that, the body will recover itself. And then, you know, he doesn't need to come back to see you anymore because he's protected from for life from severe dengue already.
What do you do when the plasma is leaking?
Well, we give them fluid, but this has to be, again, it was a learning curve for us. It was a very steep learning curve for us. It's not like you can give any type of fluid at any rate you want. You have to do it very carefully because things are leaking out. The more you give, the more it will leak. So at some point, it will leak. It doesn't come out of the skin. It's just going from the vascular system to outside the vascular system, but everything of the fluid is still within the confines of the skin of the person. So you are kind of moving the fluid around. So we have to give the fluid very carefully so that we don't overload one compartment and making the patient so difficult to breathe that he needs to be resuscitated for, okay, I can't breathe anymore because there's so much fluid inside my body. So those were the things that we went through with the through first the pediatricians had to learn it, and then we shared our experience with the adult doctors. And now I think most adult physicians who have been managing dengue, they learn how to be very careful with. They know their patient needs fluid, but they also know how to give it very carefully. Okay? So it's one of those things that you really have to play it very carefully. You can't give it too much, nor you cannot give it too little. You can't give it too early. You have to give it at the right time, at the right amount, and then just get the patient out of the storm with minimum problem. And then after that, the body recovers itself.
Right.
And the whole thing switches off. Yeah,
sure.
Okay.
I have to ask you this question because I'm sure it's at the top of many people's minds. Papaya leaves, Professor Lucy. I mean, like everybody swears by it. I mean,
controversy too.
Yeah, but IMR did research and they said there is some truth to this. I mean, what are your thoughts? I'm just thinking of the papaya leaves water interfering with the fluid, right? I mean, the fluid intake and how does that balance?
Actually, the fluid is good. Any type of fluid is good, okay? So as long as they can drink, but not pure water, any type of fluid is good for the body, right? As long as there's some electrolytes, and papaya does have some electrolytes, okay? But if you don't give in those days, before they had all the crab juice, the crab soup and the papaya, I always tell patients that in our hospital, we don't have papaya leaf, we don't have crab juice, but our patients recover without platelet transfusion, they all recover. So I think the science behind the papaya leaf, I'm afraid to say, is not very strong. When they did the study, I look at the studies, in a nutshell, there's not enough science.
Okay, Azro.
Thank you for answering that, Dr. Lucy. That has been the fierce argument in many households.
There are no loss, but at the end of the day, there's no loss, right? I mean, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You will not hydration. Lose anything. Yeah.
It's hydration.
No, it's hydration. But I think that should not preclude the fact that you need to go and see a doctor.
Right.
But I don't know how acceptable the papaya leaf juice is. If it's so bitter, they might not drink enough of it. Is it? So it would have to be like integrated with other more acceptable fluids. I always say that coconut water is good, right? The coconut water, because it's got electrolytes, it's got, and if they can eat the coconut meat, it's all the better. At least they get some nourishment, you see. Okay. So because you must remember that they have already, by the time they reach that stage, they've already had 3 to 4 days of high fever, where they have already lost quite a lot of fluid, and they haven't been eating. All right, so they're actually very catabolic at that point, meaning that the body is running on not so much on glucose already. So they're running on their reserves. So especially for children, if they're running on their reserves and their reserves are not much, then, you know, any food is still better than no food. So coconut meat is good.
Okay. We have a very quickly a question here about electrolyte drinks. We have them in cans in many forms. Is that something that could help as well?
I think we have a problem here when you drink lots of it. Okay, so it has to be moderation. Let's say if you are required to drink like 8 glasses of water, not all 8 glasses should be coconut water, or all 8 glasses are, you know, canned drinks, because that glucose will overwhelm your whole system. Because you must remember that at that point, your body is under stress. So your cortisol levels are high, adrenaline is high. So your insulin becomes very low. And, you know, you're going to overload that system, already stressed system, with more sugar. So 1 or 2 cans, I'm not going to say very much, but it cannot be like 8 cans of, 100 plus or whatever, coconut water. So 1 or 2 cups, I know this thing, but be careful with the sugar, the sugar content. And the other electrolytes are sodium and potassium. Potassium is very, very important, because when we are stressed, our kidneys don't conserve potassium. In fact, our kidneys during a stress state will reabsorb sodium and throw out potassium. So potassium is like the stepchild, you know, being thrown out. So if we don't take enough potassium, our body will become low in potassium and you feel very, very weak.
Okay, so how many bananas do we eat here?
Yes, you got to eat bananas. Okay, all right.
You got to eat coconut water, bananas, papaya leaves. Okay.
So it's all about a balance. Yes.
Thank
enough
you.
Enough water, enough salt, enough potassium.
Azrul, I'm going to leave the last question. Last question to you, Azrul.
Well, you know, Dr. Lucy, we have quite a number of innovative approaches that have been introduced over the past couple of years in an effort to control the spread of dengue. You know, we have the Wolbachia pilot project, which has been going on, I think, in more than 2 dozen sites around Malaysia. And it's been very, very successful. In fact, I think it's one of the more exciting developments in the dengue scene. So where do you think Malaysia is going to be in 5 years' time when it comes to dengue, Dr. Lucy? Because I hate to think we're still going to be stuck with thousands of cases, you know, like 20,000, 30,000, even 130,000 cases. Where do you think we are going to be in another 5 years? Still the same old, or is it going to be much more reduced?
I think it depends on how much we are going to scale up the Wolbachia project, and how much, everything is so interdependent. Yeah, so we are juggling, like throwing up so many balls in the air, and everything is like interacting with each other. And so people, the economic activities, the people movement, new people coming in. It's a new people who are coming in who are completely naive, who will be feeding the disease. And then if we manage to keep our cases down, then we will lose our herd immunity. And then all you need is one virus, and then we will have an explosion again. Okay, so it's like so difficult to predict where we are going to be when there are so many dependent factors which are not within our control, you know, climate change, and then the Wolbachia project, I think if it is implemented out, it will cut down the number of cases, but it's not going to bring it down to zero. But do remember that when we lose our herd immunity, when we are hit, we are going to get an explosion again. So how do we, you know, balance up the whole thing, you see? So it's going to be like, you know, we get some cases. But I mean, for me, for a physician, I'm now in my 60s, and I'm thinking that I better get all my 4 dengue virus. In fact, when we always joke among ourselves, yeah, we better get all our 4 dengue strains before we reach the age of 70 or 80, because that is when you the next age of when we are fragile and then we are hit by a dengue virus. You could die from that.
Right? Oh my God! I haven't been infected.
So you better get your Yeah, you better get yourself infected, you know, before you
reach boy. This is too stressful.
If you try to squeeze the whole dengue down to zero, then you are going to put a whole host of people at
risk, you know?
Yes.
Again, we have a vaccine.
Have you been infected yet?
We don't have yet.
No, we don't, yeah. Have you been infected yet?
You don't know. You don't know until you do a seroprevalence. Yeah. You don't know because a lot of it is silent.
Exactly. I don't know. I could be asymptomatic, you know. But I do know for a fact that almost every person in Malaysia knew and knows someone or has in fact been infected with dengue. So that's quite a brutal truth, right, for everyone when it comes to dengue.
That is true.
But then you have 4 strains, how more you have to multiply this 4 times.
I have about 20 more years, Azro. What about you?
Yeah, I got to stock up.
Thank you both very much for joining us. Thank you for joining us today. Professor Dr. Lucy Lam, Senior Consultant Pediatrician from University of Malaya Medical Center, and my co-hosting with me, Azro Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.